I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Judith Pond is the author of the new novel, The Signs of No. She joins me now to talk about the characters in the book and the themes she tackles in the novel. The first character we meet, as the story begins, is Rose, a divorced 50-year-old who we later find out is estranged from her daughter. I'll ask her about Rose, this fascinating character who, as our hero, is relatable for the reader. I'll also ask about other characters in the book, like Morrison and Abby, and what these characters go through. The book contends with guilt and grief, as the characters deal or don't deal with loss in their lives. They also deal with parenthood, motherhood in particular. I'll ask Judith about these themes that she explores and the characters that she spent a lot of time with as she wrote this book. Judith Pond has published fiction and poetry in a wide variety of literary journals. She is the author of 4 poetry collections, including A Shape of Breath. Visit judithpond.ca for more. The Signs of No is published by University of Calgary Press as part of their Brave and Brilliant series. We spoke about 2.5 weeks ago with Judith joining me from Calgary. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Judith Pond. Ms. Pond, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. When we first meet Rose, as we're starting the book, she's at a work function, is that right?
She's at a nearby college to the one that she teaches at, and it's an art opening.
I see. So what does she do for a living?
She teaches at a college.
I see.
Teaches critical thinking.
I see. Actually, the book starts with a scene at a playground, and there's this line in this opening scene where it's just haunted me for, several weeks after reading it. Quote, mother mistakenly imagined would never be over. It's a scene with a mother at a playground with their child.
Yeah.
I guess this is one of the themes that recurs throughout the book about the relationship between a parent and a child, right?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that, and I'm sort of groping for a way to ask about exploring that theme in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Rose has to deal with an estrangement, is that right?
Yes.
What can you tell us about what she has to deal with and why it's important to talk about that? Because, I mean, mm-hmm. Now that I think about it, there are a lot of people I know who have to contend with that in life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think her child Bean or Stella, whichever, it takes Rose a little while to realize that she has a child who has her own little path, and it's not the path of most kids. And that's, of course, where the title of the book comes from. In retrospect, she's looking back, trying to parse out all that's happened and not happened. She's trying to figure out where did this start? What were the signs? And I just think that this particular character did not want to participate in life as written, and that's why she adopts some of her unusual responses to it. For example, she has this whole phase where she believes she's Joan of Arc, and she puts herself into that ancient character as a way of separating herself from life as written, and specifically from her mother. I think that estrangement between parents and children, and often mothers and daughters, does happen more than maybe we realize.
Yeah, and it's something that we're not willing to talk about, is it?
I think not. I think we want to present ourselves the way we do on social media. You know, I'm going to Mexico. Yeah. My life is great. My family's great. That's one of the reasons I don't bother much with social media, because I've never had a life like that.
I think few of us have had lives like that, but yet I guess we're forced to contrive of situations mm-hmm. that make us presentable to social media, and mm-hmm. sometimes covering up things that have
reality.
Happened in reality
exactly.
Is easy to do. What can you say about estrangement in fiction that you can't say in any other kind of writing, nonfiction or memoir, perhaps?
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, I think that fiction is the lie that tells the truth, of course, that expression we all know. And I think that the relief of fiction is that you can transpose, the writer can transpose their own experience into characters that are fiction, and therefore thereby explore that estrangement in a way that feels safe and that the writer can take ownership of.
And the reader is invited to do the same, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Rose seems like a fascinating character because she's also very funny.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying getting to know her as I'm starting the book. Well, what is she like?
I think she's insecure. I think she doesn't believe in herself. I don't think she believes in her ability to affect the world in a positive way. But I think she's brave, and I think she's braver than she knows she is. And it's her journey to the lake and back, the far north, that helps her to inhabit more of herself as a person. I think she loves to make fun of herself in a sort of bleak and disastrous way.
Yeah, I guess we all, well, some of us like to do that for ourselves, and I guess that's why I find her almost relatable in a way.
Yeah.
We get a sense of her worries, and it's a marvelous way to set the mood, I guess, for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might not relate to her, but at least they sympathize with her. I mean, you have to like her, I guess, when you create a character like this.
Yeah, I think, the character becomes part of you. So you have to, I think as a writer, you have to love your characters, even the nasty ones, because they're your children, in a way. Yeah.
She meets early in the book this character, Morrison.
Yes.
Who's Morrison?
In what sense?
I guess, does he work at the college that she's at this event that she's at?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, he turns up at this same art opening that she goes to, and that's how she meets him. They don't work together or anything, and he has a kid who has a piece in the art show, and Rose starts right off the bat putting her foot in her mouth by making fun of some of the art there.
Mm.
Morrison proves to be generous and also to have a good sense of humor, and he kind of tells her that, oh, that's okay. He wishes all his money had paid for this kid to become a lawyer or a doctor and not somebody who puts vaginas in bottles. So he, in his world, he's a marathon runner and a master gardener, and to make a living, he's an anger management kind of counselor guy.
And I guess he and Rose, they develop a relationship, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
And
then we also encounter this character, Abby. And what's her connection to Morrison, or what can you tell us about that connection, say?
She is a former partner. She lives in another city across the country. And she has a connection with Morrison in the sense that I think psychologically they're still kind of bound up with each other a bit, as exes tend to be sometimes. And they have a little regimen where they go once a year on a trip together to do a marathon. And there's a sort of sexual component to that in that neither of them, both of them, I guess it's just Morrison who has to abstain from sex before they meet up to go on these marathon trips. And that gives some complication, some pretty substantial complication to his relationship with Rose once things get rolling.
As I mentioned a moment ago, the book is also very funny. What is it like writing and finding humor? I mean, are you by nature just someone who finds the humor in everything, even something that's bleak, say?
No, I'm kind of disaster-minded in reality. I was raised by anxious people, and I think for me, humor is a way to undermine that disaster voice inside. It's also subversive, and I think it's the best vehicle through which to tell tragedy. I think humor and tragedy are kind of sisters. soul sisters in a way. And I love to find the funny things about what's awful. I'm not in the sense that I like to make fun of tragedy or of sad things, but I guess especially where I'm concerned, once I've realized I've survived, I like to find the funny things.
Yeah, finding that laugh usually is that sort of sigh of relief, I guess.
Yeah, in a way, I guess.
And that's what I'm enjoying about the signs of no, is these moments where, if it were my life, I probably wouldn't find it amusing, but reading about someone else's, it's delightful. Did you crack yourself up when you write?
To be honest, sometimes I do.
Yeah.
And I always feel like, oh, that's a good sign. Every so often I make myself have a good laugh.
So asking that or considering that, Judith, do you think there can be beauty in loss?
Absolutely. Beauty, depth, enrichment, opening. I don't think we can fully develop unless we've experienced some loss and learned how to regard it in our own lives. It's essential. I mean, in the end, we lose everything. So it's all a rehearsal.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what scares a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'd like to gain everything we can from every situation. So if mm-hmm. there is wisdom in loss, we'd like that. But I think we're just afraid of having to go through it, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I mean, we only know what we know, which is that we live here, we have these things, we have this schedule, this partner, all of that. But that's all ephemera, and we will lose it all in the end. And I think it's important to recognize that and develop some kind of response to it in each of us in our own lives.
I'm sitting in my office where I've collected ephemera over the years. Literally, I'm thinking about what's going to happen to all this crap later on, right?
I know.
Yeah, and that's the other thing as I'm reading the book that I'm getting a great sense of is that if there is wisdom in loss, I guess for a lot of us it can't come fast enough.
The wisdom, you mean?
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, because in wisdom is relief. It's a kind of a way of assuring ourselves that, well, something came of it that I can use and be strengthened by.
Indeed. The character of Iris?
Yes.
She's 10.
Yeah.
How does she come into the story?
It's been a while since I wrote this book. She's a child, and she is the daughter. This is very complicated, but she's the daughter of the man that Abby is having a current relationship with. Abby, of course, is the ex-partner of Morrison, and Iris is Parker's daughter. Parker is Abby's boyfriend, or whatever.
Yeah.
She lives with her mom. She has two siblings. She's discontented and pissed off with life because, you know, her life is a bit chaotic. She has to go back and forth between her parents' houses. She feels like she doesn't get enough attention. So she is coping with certain forms of loss, as well as all the other characters.
Yeah, and as a result, as we get to know her in the book, does she I guess she falls into Rose's life in some way, does she?
Does she fall into Rose's life? No, she is in Abby's life.
I see.
Yeah, so this book has, as you've already seen, multiple points of view. So Iris is part of the Abby thread. And she falls into Abby's life through Parker, and Abby falls in love with Iris in the way of just thinking she's a wonderful kid and really loves her.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm starting the book. I'm trying to get a sense of where I am.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is the fascinating part as you're getting to know these characters because it is one book and you're holding it in your hands and you're wondering how this all comes together.
I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Am I to understand that this is your debut novel?
It is, yeah.
But you've written other things in the past, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of started life as a poet, I guess, and I have four collections of poetry with Oberon Press in Ottawa,
mm-hmm.
Though they're, I think, no longer publishing these days. and I've published short stories in literary journals. I have a book of linked short stories coming out next fall with Freehand Press of Calgary as well. And I've written a little bit of essays. Kind of a jack of all trades, I guess. But I've been concentrating more on big prose projects for the past, you know. I started this book in 2014. It's taken me that long to make it.
It's a very fine achievement. You have to be very proud, and I think that's why I'm enjoying many parts of the book, because the writing is lyrical in some places, and I think that must have come from the experience of being a poet.
Absolutely.
It must have, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad I trained in that medium, because poetry is all about all the things I like. It's about enormous economy,
yeah.
Kind of a tautology, but huge economy of language, resonance, wordplay, poignancy, and that informs every sentence that I make, every sentence.
And does your mind as a writer, does it change when you're writing short stories and poetry, as opposed to, say, contending with something that's fiction, because it is a bigger sort of project? Or longer, even?
Yeah. I don't think so, in the sense that, well, I compare poetry or short stories to poems, in a way. They're almost expanded poems. You have to get everything in that tiny canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where so much telescoping and economy come in. But I would say I use the very same tricks on myself, even, when I write short fiction as when I write long fiction. Basically, I listen so hard to language, and I let language lead me, or I try to, as much as possible. So I do that in both forms.
But that's a wonderful thing about language, isn't it? That our ears, they certainly work just as much when I'm reading. When you're writing, I'm sure they work, don't they, in that special way?
Yeah. I don't get the objectivity I need when I first put a sentence down. But when I come back to it the next day, I see where it works and doesn't work. And I'm always listening to see if the sentence balances out in the end. I'm kind of obsessive about that.
Yeah. I was going to ask if you always wanted to write, but I think the more interesting question is, as a keen observer of life itself, have you always been someone like that? As a kid, were you always observant of what the adults were doing and listening and watching?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think I grew up in a household where, you know, where I had to be very vigilant as a child. My father was an alcoholic, and so I was always watching and listening to see if things were all right, or if they're going to be all right, or if they're not. And I think that developed in me a sense of real attention to what was going on around me. And I'm almost a little bit too attention-giving to things, because when I'm driving, I can get distracted just by what I'm looking out the window and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand that, because even as a kid, I would, if we were in a restaurant or something like that, I'd be trying to listen to what the other people were doing at the other table, or not just their conversation, but just how they comported themselves.
Totally. And when I'm in the grocery lineup, I always watch what people are buying and try to figure out what kind of person they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm much the same. You're part of the Brave and Brilliant series from the University of Calgary Press. I've interviewed a number of the authors in this series.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
How did this book end up there?
I sent it to them and crossed my fingers.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it.
It's a great a group of writers that you're associated with.
Yeah, I'm incredibly proud to be part of this series and of the University of Calgary Press. Amazing way to start off with, you know, a first novel.
And I'm astonished at the variety of things that they've published in the series, and mm-hmm. this book really fits this collection.
Thank you.
Yeah. What was it like editing the book? Because it is a big book, and I'm sure it could have been twice the size if you wanted it to be.
I had a wonderful editor, Naomi Lewis, who works for U of C and for Freehand Press, and so I'm really excited that I get to work with her again. Mm-hmm. She was very good at showing me the big arc of the book, what worked, what didn't, what I could take out, and she pushed me to make it, to hone things as well as possible. So, yeah, I know it's a big book. I was shocked when I saw the size of it. But, yeah, a good editor is worth everything.
Do you get proprietary, though, about your writing? I mean, the editor has to wield an axe sometimes. And,
yes.
And I would think that'd be tough to, say, have to part with something that you've spent a lot of time with.
That's a really good question. Yeah, yeah, it hurts because sometimes you write so much and you have to lose it. But I just call it engine starting. You know, it's, and I don't really think that anything is ever really lost because it's all part of developing the craft. So if somebody like Naomi or one of the people in my writer's group tells me that this doesn't work, you're off on a tangent, I trust it.
Yeah. Are you working on another novel now?
Yeah, I am. I finished one 2 years ago, and I've had to put it away for a while because of this book, and the next one is coming out with Freehand, but I'm back rewriting it now, and I'm having an exciting time with it.
Is that more exciting, the rewriting and the editing, than... Because sometimes I talk to writers, and when a burst of energy or inspiration hits them, mm-hmm. The writing can be quite exciting,
yeah.
And I'm sure it is. Do you find enjoyment in the editing and the rewriting?
I do. I also despair. I mean, you know, it's been 2 years since I finished this book, so I found that I didn't remember half of it.
Mm.
So I had to go all the way back through it and make a little, what I called a scene key, so that I've got first lines of every single scene in it now, and I can kind of go back and forth and know what's what. But yeah, this time around, I almost am beginning to think that the first draft was just tailor's tacks. You know, it was just the beginning skeleton, and now it's really starting to talk to me, and not in ways I expected, but that's okay.
Yeah, I guess the putting it away for a bit, I think, does help, doesn't it?
I think so. It helps and it scares you, but I think you need the distance. You really do, because you begin to see then where you need to make cuts and changes that you could not see before because you're too attached to it.
Yeah. So what is it like now? Because you did start the Signs of No 10 years ago, and, mm-hmm. and you have had some time away from it. Now
yeah.
that it's out and you're talking about it to people,
mm-hmm.
What is it like to look back, not just at the book itself, but the characters themselves?
Thank you. That's a great question. I'm fond of them all. I love them all. They're my children. So I'm really happy to have them between covers. I'm happy to have it finished and to, in a way, I've kind of said goodbye to it. I'm not looking at it anymore. I'm just letting it do what it's doing out there, hoping
yeah.
for the best.
But it must be nice to crack the covers and revisit them sometimes.
It is, yeah, it yeah. is. And I'm sure that parts of them will revisit me forever.
Yeah.
You know. I have a child, of course, with whom I have been estranged for a period of short, not all that long, but it felt like forever at the time. And the book helped me to deal with that and to cope with it and forgive myself, and I'm happy to say now that we have a wonderful relationship, and I'm so grateful for that.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Judith, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you today. I'm looking forward to finishing this book, and congratulations and continued good luck with it. Thanks for
Thanks
this.
Thanks so much, Joseph.
The website for more is at judithpond.ca. The book is called The Signs of No. It's published by the University of Calgary Press, which is part of their Brave and Brilliant series. Its author, Judith Pond, joined me on the line from Calgary in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.